Thank you. Well, it's my pleasure to talk in this session to honor Ken. I mean, I've known Ken for many years, and in the early years mainly as a competitor, but in recent years more as a collaborator, and I always enjoy visiting him in Tokyo, where we get lots of good new ideas. It's also a particular pleasure to talk about electron capture supernovae, because Ken has really done most of the original work in this area in the early 80s. If you look back at these early papers, some of the details have changed since, but the basic story is still the same. There's also been a lot of new interest in the last couple of years in these electron capture supernovae, which I'll talk about today. But first, I suspect that two-thirds of you don't even know what an electron capture supernova is. So I'll define that first, show you some of Ken's original work only, some recent simulations, and why these supernovae are of interest. I will not talk that much about accretion-induced collapse, but I will talk about merger-induced collapse, which I think is maybe more interesting to this audience anyway. Well, what is an electron capture supernova? Now, you all know, of course, of the classical iron core collapse. You have, at the end of the life of a massive star, you have an iron core, and if that iron core is more massive than the Chandrasekhar mass, since there's no energy source, it has to collapse and will form a neutron star or black hole. Now, it's still not quite clear, not entirely clear, how these core collapses lead to a supernova explosion. The favorite model is that some of the neutrinos, after perhaps half a second or so, actually reverse the infall and produce an explosion. Now, that's the standard textbook story. Now, electron capture supernovae occur long before you have an iron core. In fact, they occur in degenerate oxygen, neon, magnesium cores. When these cores reach a critical density, and that critical density is about 4.5 times 10 to 9 grams per cubic centimeter, which can be translated into critical mass for the oxygen, neon, magnesium core of about 1.3 solar masses, you get electron captures mainly onto magnesium 24. So these electrons are removed, and since this is a degenerate core that is supported by electron degeneracy, the core of the star all of a sudden loses pressure support. And it's that loss of pressure support that triggers the collapse. And even if you have subsequent oxygen burning, it cannot stop it, and you ultimately end up with a neutron star, a relatively low mass neutron star. Now, this collapse is quite different from the iron core collapse. In particular, most of this core will collapse to form the compact remnant. So this means that it's actually much easier to produce a supernova, because the binding energy of the envelope is much smaller and you need less energy. It also means that very few heavy elements are ejected in this explosion. Now, in his early papers, Ken looked systematically at stars with helium cores around two solar masses and followed their evolution all the way to core collapse phase. This is an example for a 2.4 solar mass star. See, this burns helium first and then has a series of carbon shell flashes, during which the oxygen neon magnesium core grows, and eventually the density in this core is large enough to get an electron capture supernova. Now, Ken estimated that this would happen to helium stars in the range of 2 to 2.5 solar masses, which translates to initial masses between 8 and 10 solar masses. Now, this translation, of course, depends a little bit on other factors like convective overshooting and so, but that's the basic story. So it's a fairly narrow mass range at the bottom of the mass range where you expect supernova explosion. But because of the initial mass function, it's not an insignificant fraction of stars that can be produced, neutron stars that could be produced in this way. One of the particular applications Ken was interested in was the Crab pulsar, in order to explain various properties of the remnant and also the low explosion, inferred explosion energy. Now, I think there's still no evidence for any hydrogen in the Crab pulsar, in the Crab remnant. But if the progenitor was in this mass range, you needed some mechanism to get rid of the hydrogen-rich envelope, and one way is might be due to a binding action. But there are some complications that we're not going to. Now, there have been, actually in the last year, there have been two papers published simulating electron capture supernovae. One by Dessart, which is a two-dimensional simulation of a rotating core, and one by Kitauer, Young, and Hillebrand. It's a one-dimensional calculation. And, well, if you look at this, what you see here, well, you can't see it very well, but well, this is the radius as a function of time of various mass shells. And initially, the radii decrease, so you get collapse. And after about 100 milliseconds or so, this contraction is reversed, and you get expansion. And you get a successful supernova. Now, what these calculations confirmed pretty much is that this type of explosion works with the delayed neutrino mechanism. And it's quite easy, works quite easily. It also showed that the explosion energy should be very low, less than about 10 to 50 ergs. So it's of interest compared to Paolo's talk, where he talked about the super energetic supernovae. There's also at least one class of supernovae predicted that have energies that are significantly less than the canonical 10 to 51 ergs. And also the calculation showed that very few metals were ejected. Of particular interest to what I'm going to say later is that this explosion is quite fast. It only takes 100 or perhaps 200 milliseconds to reverse the collapse into an explosion. Now, this is of interest to pulsar people because it may imply that you get a pulsar with a neutron star with a very low kick velocity. Now, there's still a lot of debate what causes supernova kicks, but one of the best models, perhaps, and best is a subjective statement here, is that this is caused by standing accretion shock instability in the collapse phase. Now, this instability requires a fairly slow explosion, an explosion that lasts at least 400, 500 milliseconds, because this instability, the gross time scale of this instability is tens of milliseconds. So if the explosion is very fast, then this instability can't grow. And if that's the cause of a supernova kick, you don't expect a supernova kick from this type of explosion. Now, things are more complicated because whether this happens may also depend on whether you're a single star or a binary star. In particular, if you look at single stars in this mass range may experience dredge up in the HB phase, which reduces the core mass significantly. This is shown in this diagram, which shows the maximum final mass of the helium core as a function of zero H main sequence mass. And if you look at this solid blue curve, this is from calculations by Paul Ahrens and Langer, you see it rise and then you see this big jump. The difference here is that stars below this jump have this second dredge up, and the core mass is significantly reduced. Stars above that don't experience it, and therefore you end up with much higher helium star masses. What is also indicated here, but that you can't see, is the range where you might expect the electron capture supernovae. Basically, none of the single stars for this calculation would end up in the range where you get an electron capture supernova. Now, that could be avoided if you lose the hydrogen envelope, because it's the hydrogen envelope that causes the dredge up. And so if you're in a binary where the envelope is removed, you end up with the range of possible helium masses, which is shown as this striped band using calculations by Bernstein and Langer. So based on this, we suggested that there may actually be a dichotomy in the sense that in order to get an e-capture, electron capture supernova, you may need a close binary, which then produces a low kick. And if you have the normal ion core collapse, you end up with a high kick. Now, this has some attractive features because it could, for example, explain why the single pulses all seem to have received large kicks. There are very few low velocity single pulses, radio pulses observed. On the other hand, there's lots of evidence that not all neutron stars receive these large kicks. There's evidence from X-ray, some X-ray binders that have very low eccentricity. And there's also the problem is if all neutron stars in globular clusters received these large kicks, they would all be ejected and you wouldn't have any neutron stars left. Also, Ed Vandenhoven and Jacinta Devi have argued that the properties of double neutron star systems in some cases favor low kicks. Now, there's been, since we proposed it, there's been more work on this. In particular, since our calculations were slightly different from Ken's original calculations, Arndt-Jan Paul Arends, in his PhD thesis, examined more the conditions for when you get e-capture supernovae in HGB stars. And he looked at how it depends on the mass loss rates, the Tretyakov efficiency, and the metallicity. Now, what I've shown here is his best model. And what this shows is the final fate of stars of initial mass, given here, from 4 to 10 solar masses, as a function of the logarithm of the metallicity. So at the top, that's where your solar metallicity, he concludes, well, you get a carbon-oxygen Y12 up to about 7 solar masses. Then there's a range where you get an oxygen-neon-magnesium Y12. There's hardly any parameter range for an electron-captured supernova, and then above that, you get the normal iron core collapse. So it's similar to what I showed in the previous calculation. But this depends on metallicity. As you go towards lower metallicity, first you have lower wind mass loss rates, and also the Tretyakov efficiency changes. You then start to get, well, fewer oxygen-neon-magnesium white dwarfs, but a larger parameter range where you can expect the electron-captured supernova. At the lowest metallicities, you even find some parameter space for these infamous type 1.5 supernovae. Also, on the poles, he has looked more at the effects of binary evolution, and he finds also that in many cases you get mass transfer that actually may prevent the electron capture in these binaries. But there are other complications. Now, one particular interesting system, which I think may have formed at least one electron capture supernova, is the double pulsar. Now, you all have heard of the double pulsar. Ed showed it yesterday. It's the system of that has two radio pulsars in an orbit of 2.4 hours. And of particular interest is the second pulsar, the slowly spinning pulsar, has a mass of about 1.25 solar masses. Now, I think this is a good candidate for a neutron star that formed an electron-captured supernova. Now, the evidence is rather circumstantial, but it's based on the following arguments. Well, first, this low mass is the typical mass you expect from an electron-captured supernova. There's also evidence that when this second neutron star formed, it did not receive a large kick. And that comes from the orbital parameters, the fact that the eccentricity is very low, the space velocity is low, and particularly interesting is that the pulsar A is aligned with the orbital axis, which means you cannot have received a large kick out of the orbital plane. Now, if that is true, then that opens an interesting possibility, namely that you can use the system to test the equation of state of nuclear matter. And the reason for that is because to get this electron capture supernova, there's this critical density for the collapse, which can be translated into critical mass of the oxygen-magnesium core. And Pierre Lesavre estimated that it's 1.37 plus minus 0.05. Of course, in this case, we can also measure the neutron star mass after the supernova. And that should be equal to the pre-collapse core mass minus the binding energy of the neutron star. So if this critical mass is equal to the pre-collapse core mass, we can use this to constrain the binding energy, which of course is a strong function of the equation of state. Now this is what we try to do here, and what you see as on the x-axis is the baryonic mass of a neutron star, and this is the gravitational mass, and you get different curves for different equations of state. If you assume that this mass is the pre-collapse mass, and you, of course, know the post-collapse mass, you get this little rectangle. Now, if that were the whole story, it would quite tightly constrain the equation of state in a regime where it's not easily tested. Of course, things are a bit more complicated because during the explosion, you may expect that some of the core mass is actually lost. Now, the calculations show that it's not much, but there is some mass left of at least a few thousands of solar mass. So one should probably shift this rectangle a little bit to the left. But nevertheless, it's a method in principle of how you can constrain the equation of state. You can use the stellar physics to get the pre-collapse conditions combined with some understanding of the supernova to determine what these properties are. The main assumption in all of this, of course, is that this is an electron capture supernova, which is not easy to prove. Now, accretion-induced collapse. Now, again, one of the seminal papers on this was by Ken, in this case with Eco Eben in 1985, where they showed that if the accretion rate is larger than about the 50 Eddington accretion rate onto a white dwarf, you get a carbon shell flash. And that then produces a series of carbon shell flashes at successively smaller mass shells, which ultimately converts a carbon-oxygen white dwarf into an oxygen-magnesium white dwarf. And as we've heard earlier today, oxygen-neon-magnesium white dwarfs always collapse and never explode in a thermal explosion. Now, these have been invoked for all sorts of things, particularly to form neutron stars and low-mass exobinaries. There's an occasional fan of it, Hercules X1. Josh Quinley is proposing for all sorts of things. In particular, he has suggested also that it might be a way of producing millisecond pulses with low magnetic fields. Others use it to produce neutron stars with low kicks. Now, this is not very poorly justified, but at least the calculation I showed you earlier now provides some support that you may get neutron stars with low kicks. Perhaps more interesting are the merger-induced collapses. And double degenerate mergers are perhaps a prime candidate to produce neutron stars in an electron capture supernova. I show you here a recent calculation by Stefan Rosvog of a 0.6 and 0.9 solar mass merger. Now, we know that the rates, or we expect that the rates of these mergers are very high. The rate should be comparable to the type 1a rate. Theory says, population that says that there should be a few times 10 to minus 3 per year of these mergers. And this doesn't depend really much on which population synthesis code you use. They all agree basically on the 10 to minus 3. The number in front may vary from calculation to calculation. The observations Ralf Napiewoczki showed, I think, are probably consistent with the theoretical estimate. I mean, he didn't make a strong statement in his talk, but it looks consistent to me. But if the rates are so high, that means that a significant fraction of all neutron stars could have formed in this way. Of course, the big question still is, which was already debated earlier, is do we get merger-induced collapse or a type 1a supernova? Now, initially, of course, you would expect that the accretion rate would be much higher than this critical accretion rate I quoted earlier. And is that the end of the story? Well, probably not, because the initial configuration is actually quite different from the calculation of these accretion calculations. And we recently, Sung-Chul Yoon, Stefan Rosvog, and I recently looked at the evolution of one of the remnants of a double-degenerate merger. The important point is that after the merger, you don't have a simple disk star structure. One-third to one-half of the disrupted white dwarf will be dumped onto the massive white dwarf on a dynamical timescale for simple stability reasons. And so what you really have is, at the center, you have the cold white dwarf, the massive white dwarf, surrounded by a high-entropy, low-density envelope. And then surrounding it, you have a Keplerian, quasi-Keplerian disk. This is the outcome of Stefan's calculations I showed you earlier, which shows exactly that structure. So initially, at least, the evolution of the massive white dwarf is controlled by the accretion from this envelope, not from the disk accretion. Now, in order to look at this, Sung-Chul Yoon took Stefan's models and used the conditions in the stellar evolution code to follow the evolution of this core envelope structure, because this is a basic stellar problem. Now, you would expect that the accretion rate in this case is very high, and therefore you would again get into these carbon shell flashes. Somewhat to our surprise, that's not what he found, or not necessarily what he found. What he found is that because of this envelope structure, the density is high enough at the interface between the cold core and the hot envelope that neutrino losses are important. In fact, neutrino cooling can completely carry away the energy produced by the compressional heating. And if you didn't have carbon burning initially, carbon shell ignition could be avoided under certain circumstances. And if it is avoided completely, it would ultimately produce not a neutron star, but it would produce a thermonuclear explosion. Now, in order to assess this, he looked at it in more details and derived systematically what the conditions were for whether you get this carbon shell ignition or not. And he basically found these are the three criteria. Immediately after the merger, once you are in a quasi-static situation, the maximum temperature has to be less than the ignition temperature for carbon. Now, that was justified or satisfied in the calculations by Stefan Rosbrook I showed before. Of course, you still have an accretion disk surrounding it, and you still have that accretion disk problem, but probably at a later phase. And if the accretion rate is less than this, again, you could avoid carbon ignition. Now, all of this, of course, may depend on the properties of the white dwarfs and also the thermal state of the white dwarf. Now, I don't want to argue here that this saves the double degenerate model. Indeed, my personal conclusions, and these are my conclusions, not necessarily those of my co-authors, is that still doesn't make this the dominant channel for type 1a supernovae, but that there could be cases where the double degenerate model works and the situation is more complicated than people have considered so far. And that's a good thing.
Remains a terribly important channel to think about here. So let's start with our organizer.
Do you think the minimum mass neutron star would come from your from the electron capture supernovae?
Well, I mean, not necessarily, because you know the critical the transition mass for the iron core can go down. It can be less than that. And indeed, we know there's one neutron star that has a lower mass than this. That's why it's difficult to tell, is it really an electron capture supernova or not?
The carbon ignition in merging white dwarfs very much depends on stereo numerics method and condition, and so I will mention later. But
yeah.
Just
no, I think, yeah, I mean, you told me earlier that you did similar calculations in Tokyo and you got carbon ignition in the early phase. Now, I know that Stefan Rosbrook's calculations are quite sophisticated, and he thinks that as you make it more realistic, the temperature goes down. But it's certainly an important issue, and I think, but it's one that I think is tractable. Moreover, of course, you also need to consider this may depend on the initial conditions.
Well, we may need something like this. After all, there are the fast declining, rather dim supernovae that are found in the old populations. And so, you know, there might be a special subclass which has more or less the right properties. So we don't want to prejudice your investigation of this. But it would be very interesting to find.
You're not
very
interesting as we have thought about these.
Yes, I'm sure you have. But, you know, it would be very interesting to see whether the outcome of this is something like the class that we kind of need.
Yes, absolutely.
Let me take a chairman's prerogative for just 1 second. If you consider the rotation, oxygen neon collapse, those will end up, this has to do with whether you get kicks or not. If it's rotating, then you have plenty of time on the time that you're trying to evolve this thing. You'll have differential rotation. You will build up a magnetic field, I think. And then if you make jets and they're unbalanced, you might kick it. So the question of whether this collapse automatically gives you no kick, I think, needs a little
thought. In the framework of the model I discussed.
Understood. Just
and I said it's not clear.
Just a minor correction to the numbers you were quoting for the explosion energy of these collapses. In the original paper, Kitaura in 1D already got something was a bit above 10 to the 50. But now he has done two-dimensional simulations again that put in the convection. And there the neutrino luminosity is boosted that the outcome in the end is something 3 times 10 to the 50. Okay. So I think for these type of collapses, having an overall energy of 3 times 10 to the 50 is more realistic, which brings it actually in close agreement with these subluminous type 2Ps.
Dessin had claimed that it was less than 10 to the 50.
I know, but we get more now.
Other questions, comments?
Yes, sir.
Well, I just want to make some comments because the original work, what I have done, is a little bit different because in that case, the electron capture itself is an energy generation mechanism. And so when we capture the electrons and it changes the entropy distribution through the electron, the Fermi potential become a little bit different, and so that it itself makes entropy generations, and also through say excited the electron capture makes the atoms to the excited state, and so that from that excited state, it releases some gamma rays. And so that, as like the case of carbon burning, electron capture process itself is a kind of energy generation.
But are you arguing that
and so that it is some kind of competitive mechanism to enhance the temperature and the enhance or make this collapse. And so it's not so simple as like the case, not normal.
But you still agree that they collapse?
Yes, but it is only evident that after the simulation.
Right. Yes, I mean, you have other competing factors, the neutrino cooling in particular, I suspect. And as I said, you may have oxygen burning during the collapse. But
great. Okay. One more.
And you've got 30 seconds.
No, I can't. Sure.
You mentioned the crab, which is one of the poster children,
yes.
Twice.
Yes.
Once with a question mark. How do you think the crab fits into this picture? Do you think it was one of these things?
Well, I don't think I should answer that. I think Ken should answer that.
Graceful answer. All right. Let's thank Philip for a very stimulating talk. Okay, now we're going to segue.